Shrink Wrap Radio number 469, a Jungian take on diagnostic categories with Steve Buser, MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is psychiatrist Dr. Steven Buser, publisher of Chiron Publications and co-founder of the Asheville Jung Center. We'll be discussing the book he co-authored with fellow psychiatrist Lynn Cruz, MD, which is titled DSM-5 Insanely Simplified. For more information about Dr. Steven Buser, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Steve Buser, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you in a conversation here because you and I have been working together for a while as strategic partners, even though we're on opposite ends of the country.
Yes, we are. Different time zones, too.
Yeah. So congratulations on your new book that you co-authored with Dr. Lynn Cruz, which is titled DSM-5 Insanely Simplified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It was a delight to bring it together. As many creations, it took a couple more years than we anticipated, but it was really fun you bringing it to life.
Well, I'm not surprised that it took a lot of time, and we can get into why that might be the case as we go along. But speaking of insane, which you have in the title,
yes,
I know you as a Jungian-oriented psychiatrist, a founder of the Asheville Jung Center, and a principal at the Jungian publishing house, Chiron Publishing. So this is not the book I would have expected from you. How did you come to write this particular book?
Yeah, it's a different aspect of what we do. I have really three hats that I wear. One is Chiron Publications. You mentioned that we took over Chiron, like the Greek centaur, C-H-I-R-O-N, Chiron, about 2 years ago. So we've been publishing books most all on Jungian psychology aspects, many of whom which you've interviewed the authors, James Hollis and Nancy Ferlatte and a bunch of others as well. So that's one piece I do is Chiron Publications. The other piece I've done for a few years that you and I have engaged with is the Asheville Jung Center. We've had that since 2008, so a number of years, and we plug into seminars out of Zurich, Switzerland, usually Murray Stein and others. We've had some delightful seminars. I just love doing that. And those are kind of my side jobs. Yeah, I love publishing. I love doing seminars and hosting them. But really what I do to pay the bills is psychiatry. So I've got a private practice here in the Asheville, North Carolina area with Len Cruz. Len Cruz is my psychiatry partner as well. And we've been practicing here 15 to 20 years, seeing patients day in and day out. And that's what this book is about. It's about the years of working together with patients and seeing what can we do to kind of find a different way of looking at psychiatric diagnosis, different way of looking at mental health, and what's a way of doing so, particularly in context of all the changes. There's some huge changes, which I'm sure we'll talk about today, but DSM-5 from 2 years ago, ICD-10 in 2 months, we'll be switching over. Even CPT, the CPT codes, another way we get paid, they all changed 2 years ago as well. So if you're a mental health private practice provider, you're getting bombarded with a lot of change over the last 2 years. And this book is really to both help the providers navigate that change, but also for the clients, the patients as well, to look at a different way of how we see mental illness and really mental health.
Well, now you mentioned Lynn as your psychiatric partner. I'm under the impression that you're an MD as well, or do I have that wrong?
Yes, exactly. MD refers to the psychiatry. So if you look at psychiatrists, we're all MDs. Psychologists are usually PhDs or PsyDs. So, right, we're MD psychiatrists.
Here. Okay.
So we do a lot of prescribing. We do a lot of medications, do a lot of CAT scans and MRIs and neurofeedback. We do a lot of the general medical pieces, looking at thyroid and anemias, anything that could cause depression or psychosis or anxiety. You know, we're involved in looking at the medical components of that as well.
Sure. Now, let's expand some of the alphabet soup. Tell us what DSM stands for, ICD, and I think you said CPT.
Yes, and I apologize for all the jargon there. DSM, which is one of the main pieces in this book, although really ICD-10 as well. DSM stands for Diagnostic Statistical Manual dash version 5.
And that was put out originally, and I guess still, by the American Psychiatric Association, right?
Exactly right. 1952. The original DSM came out in 1952, although really the roots go back all the way to 1844. In 1844, we had the Statistical Manual for the Use of Institutions for the Insane, which isn't very politically correct nowadays, but that was really the precursor of the DSM, and that was more collecting data of the various institutions in the 1800s, which weren't so nice places, one over the cuckoo's nest-ish. But they were collecting data on the statistical diagnoses of who was in these institutions. Gradually, over the next 100 years, that developed into the DSM in 1952, really from the outskirts of World War II. The psychiatrists that came back from World War II developed a kind of new nomenclature and really a manual of how we diagnose clients in this modern era. And then every few years, that's changed. So the DSM-1, of course, became the DSM-2, 3, 4, and 5. But the DSM-4 was released back in 1994. So it's been a good 20 years since we've had a new DSM. That's why for the current generation of therapists, this is really a big change. Because it's been the old one for 20 years.
Yeah, and even though the DSM is out of the American Psychiatric Association, there's considerable input from psychologists, I believe, as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, they're pretty broad in their structure of this. It's a big work in progress. They have study groups, working groups. There's literally hundreds of psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers that go into the development of the DSM, which is good and bad. That big a bureaucracy, you're going to have some difficulties with it, but it certainly is a consensus document, I would say.
Yeah. And I think of what else did I want to say? Did you tell us what the ICD stands for?
No, I didn't.
Let's go there.
The ICD refers to the International Classification of Diseases, ICD, and that's a global effort. DSM-5 is more of an American intervention. I think parts of the world use it as well, but it's really a U.S. Focused. The ICD-10 is international, put out by the World Health Organization, and the ICD-10 has all the diagnosis medical-wide. So unlike the DSM, which is really just psychiatric, psychological diagnoses, the ICD-10 is everything from strep throat to heart attacks to diabetes to schizophrenia to depression. So the ICD-10 is much broader and the DSM-5 is more narrow. Usually they correlate pretty close. And as the DSM-5 was developed, they tried to also match it to the new ICD-10. The ICD-9, the current version, has been in effect for 35 years. So we have been an entire generation and then some of physicians have been using the old ICD-9. So the fact that that's coming out soon to the ICD-10 is a big change, much bigger than the DSM-5. They went from 13,000 diagnoses in ICD-9 to 68,000 in ICD-10. So an increase of 500% in the diagnoses, with this new manual.
And so that's absolutely mind-boggling. And
yes, it is.
It certainly accounts for the title of your book, DSM-5, insanely simplified, because you talk not only about the DSM-5, but you're also talking about ICD-10. Mm-hmm. And so you've got, you actually trying to simplify and compress and make understandable the vast number of codes, which, what a task to take on. No wonder it took, you know, a couple years.
Right.
Yeah.
No wonder. DSM-5 is 1,000 pages. It's 990-some pages. So this is a huge, you know, tome. That's just the DSM-5. The ICD-10 is, of course, even bigger. And we really try to digest the DSM-5 and really take it down into, well, what does a clinician or even a client that's under treatment, what do they really need to know of these 1,000 pages? What are the core, you know, pieces of it? And actually, the first 25 pages of our book, that's really what we do. We take the 1,000 pages of DSM-5 and digest it into just bullet points. So for major depression, what do you need? You need, you know, 2 weeks of sleep, appetite, energy, fatigue, you know, sadness, you know, a number of symptoms for a two-week period with clinical impairment, and that's it. So we really digest it down as easy as possible. And then we include the DSM-5 codes, but also the ICD-10 codes. Because October 1st, if you're a therapist or psychiatrist, psychologist, and don't use the new ICD-10 codes, you won't get paid. Payment will shut down as of October 1, and that's just around the corner. So it's really crucial for, you know, us providers to be ready with the new ICD-10 coding.
This seems like it would be a really burdensome change for, say, for somebody who's an individual practitioner, maybe a solo therapist without a staff. To help them.
Right.
Man.
If you're part of a big organization, it's not a problem. You'll have some bean counter somewhere which will guide the process. But yeah, if you're in solo practice, and we're in a small practice, there's really just a handful of therapists that are here in our office, you really have to take the bull by the horns and integrate an entire new system with it.
Yeah, so that really makes it clear what your book's contribution is and why it's going to be important to all therapists who are listening. I don't mind giving it a plug right now.
Well, thank you. I think so, but I'm a little biased.
Yeah. Now, what about CPT? As if we didn't have enough. What was the CPT that you referred to?
I can't remember the, what did that mean? Something about procedures. So like clinical procedures and terminology, I think, but don't quote me on that one. That one hit us 2 years ago. So in 2013, the government, in their vast wisdom, decided to delete every single code we've ever used for treatment. Not the diagnosis code, but the treatment code. And treatment means if I do psychotherapy for an hour, that used to be 90806. And I had those codes memorized, and I'd write out 90806 on my bill, submit it to Blue Cross or Medicare, and I hopefully got paid. In 2013, they deleted all of mental health's codes and really complicated them. For therapists, not too bad, but as a psychiatrist, I now have to divide the time that I do, how much of my time is medication-oriented, evaluation and management of medicines, how much of my time is talk therapy. And I have a alphabet soup of codes I need to mix and match to present it, you know, there. And Medicare gets mad if I don't mix up the codes with sufficient, you know, frequency. You know, they think I'm cheating somehow, and it's a very complicated new system. That one, though, we've had for 2 years. So if you haven't figured that out as a therapist, you've already gone out of business. But the ICD-10 is really the big change now with that. And the CPT wasn't that bad. It took a few months of chaos, but after a while, you got used to the silliness of the new coding, and that one's under a belt, I would say, at least for now.
Yeah. You know, I bailed out of private practice therapy many years ago, and and part of the reason was that it was about the time that that we were having to for reinsurance reimbursement, we had to, you know, start digesting and being able to use a lot of this stuff, and in truth, a lot of people were being forced to be less than totally forthright with the insurers because they were being boxed into, well, let's see, I have to use one of these categories. I'm not sure it describes what I'm doing, but this is maybe as close as I can get. Or if I keep using the same one, as you pointed out, they're going to cut me off. So I have to show that there's progress or whatever. And so it's weird that therapists are being sort of by the bean counters, I would say, being shoehorned and boxed in ways that mm-hmm. are totally unpredictive, unproductive for mm-hmm. the clients that they're treating.
And really increasing at a ferocious velocity. It seems every year there's more and more of that. There's something else called PQRS, which I won't worry about, but it's quality improvement. You have to show all these different measures. There's EMR, electronic medical records, and for us physicians, we get penalized if we don't change over to electronic medical records. So there's a huge push to do that, and that adds another layer of complexity, and you can't clone your progress notes. You've got to do various changes. You've got to document 40 to 50 things in every note. The business of medicine has really shifted, and I don't blame people at all for wanting to get out. It's very hard to maintain to follow the rules that they demand when they're changing every month or two, and you're spinning your wheels trying to catch up with the latest new rules. But ICD-10 is the next one up, and it's a big one. It's one that if you ignore that one, you know, it's a tidal wave coming. You really have to be ready for that.
Wow. And so we're talking about, you know, 68,000 codes and the DSM, a 1,000-page book. So I should hasten to let listeners know that your book, which I have in my hand, is about 100 pages long.
Insanely simplified.
Yeah, insanely. Insanely, again, insanely does seem to be the right word. But is this enough to keep a person afloat, the information in here? Would you say?
Yes and no. I mean, it's highly digested, meaning if you were a brand new therapist, you know, in training, you know, say, and you want to learn how to diagnose, you know, clinical depression versus generalized anxiety disorder versus panic disorder, it would be a nice refresher. It would give you the bullet points, but it certainly doesn't replace a thorough understanding of diagnosis. I mean, that can't be insanely simplified. That's a hard art. But if you're a clinician that's been out there for a while, that's gone through the training, who's been seeing patients, who knows the difference between depression and anxiety, and all you really need is somebody to navigate you through the changes and the coding and the diagnostic criterion, I think it's excellent for that. In my own practice, I keep a copy of the book right on my consultation table. When I see a patient, I'm trying to think, is this persistent depressive disorder or schizoaffective disorder, depressed type, or an adjustment disorder with depressed features? And I'll just flip to that page and glance at, oh, yeah, well, that fits. It's persistent depressive disorder. And it's because I've got the bullet points right there. I don't have to flip through 40 pages of the DSM-5 itself trying to digest that. So for the new therapist, it's not enough. But if you're a seasoned clinician, this is, I think, a great refresher. It's got all the data right there and points you in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've got a lot of listeners in the UK and in Australia who are therapists. And would this book be useful to them? I mean, they're in a different country. Things may work differently. Mm-hmm. Or are things so homogenized that this would be useful to them as well?
It would definitely, you know, work. ICD-10 is international, so the entire world, you know, has or is shifting over to ICD-10. And if I remember right, Canada was ahead of us, as they are in many things, it seems like, along those lines. So I believe they're already using ICD-10, or if not, will be soon. And there's a lot of overlap with the DSM-5 and ICD-10. So, yes, if you're a therapist anywhere that speaks English, because it's written in English, of course, the summary of the criterion, you know, part would be very helpful. That's that first section. Those first 25 pages is really a digestion of the DSM-5 and ICD-10, has all the codes, has all the criterion. So absolutely. The second part of the book is more of a theoretical shift of, even though we have to use the ICD-10, we have to use the DSM-5, can we get away from this labeling phenomenon where we label somebody, they have bipolar disorder, they have schizophrenia, versus is there a spectrum of illness that we're all on the planet? Every one of us here has subtle symptoms of various, you know, components, and can we see diagnosis in a different light? You know, that part of the book, you know, is not administrative, you know, bureaucratic at all. It's looking at a different way of viewing your diagnosis.
What a lot to pack into a 100-page book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, now, I need to ask you about who's the audience for this book. I mean, clearly, clearly therapists is the target audience. Is there any reason why listeners who do not have to deal with insurance reimbursement would want to read this book?
I think so. Yes, we really wrote the book with two audiences in mind. One is the clinician, so the therapist in a broad sense, psychiatrists, you know, family physicians, you know, therapists, counselors, social workers. A lot of family docs have really enjoyed the book as well because that same ICD-10, DSM-5 is affecting their clinical practice. But besides providers, the other main audience for the book really are patients, clients, or really just anybody that wants to learn a different way of viewing mental health, you know, with that. Yeah, I see dozens of patients a week, and many of them, you know, see the book in the waiting room and ask, you know, for a copy of that. Because the book is really written for somebody suffering from mental illness as well, because it destigmatizes, you know, what they have. There's a lot of normalizing energy in it of, you know what, we're all on the spectrum somewhere of bipolarity. You may not be psychotic and hospitalized and running down the road with aliens chasing you, but yeah, you may have extra creativity. You may be more artistic. You may, you know, say things that you regret, you know, sometimes. So seeing it as a spectrum has really empowered, you know, clients to feel less labeled as ill and more of, okay, I just got the spectrum of bipolarity or anxiety or depressiveness. And it's not that I'm defective somehow, it's just that I've got an extra level of that and I need some talk therapy or even some medications to help me through that. So we have a lot of patients, you know, clients that will, you know, get the book as well, or anybody who's interested just in mental health and wants to learn more about it. You don't have to be a clinician, you know, to gain quite a bit from the book.
Well, the spectrum notion makes a lot of sense. I know in abnormal psychology or psychopathology classes, undergraduate, graduate, there's the what they call the medical student syndrome, where you start seeing yourself in every condition and go, oh my God, I've got this, I've got that. And whoever's teaching that course is quick to say, or the textbook is quick to point out that, hey, these really go along a continuum and everybody has got some of this. Everybody's got some obsessive compulsive qualities in their personality, and it's more a matter of degree. So you're kind of pulling out and making that insight explicit.
And the medical student syndrome is a great example of that, of all of us are on these spectrums. In the book, we define 8 primary psychiatric spectrums. Not that there's only 8. You could develop more if you wanted to. But we saw these 8 as the main spectrums. When I looked back over the 25 years I've been seeing patients and doing this kind of work, yeah, there were certain symptom clusters that I would see over and over again that really benefited from therapy or medications or other treatments. So those 8, which are depression, mania, anxiety, psychosis, attention, substance abuse, codependency, and personality function, those were the 8 that we saw as more common and more, you know, clinically seen with that. But when you look at all 8 of those, every one of us are somewhere on those spectrums. So if you're a medical student and you have a little more obsessiveness, which is good, it probably made you a little more higher achieving and you did your homework more in time and you're a little more organized with it, or if you have some anxiety or even some depressiveness, you'll see yourself on that spectrum. And when you see the full-blown case of it, your mind jumps to that and says, oh, I've got, you know, major depression with mood-congruent psychotic features. And, well, no, you don't have that. You just have some mild to moderate depressiveness. So the spectrum really helps with that, where people are either over-assuming what they have or just want to see themselves, you know, within the continuum of normalcy, really.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned obsessive-compulsiveness and graduate school. My experience was you couldn't get through it. if you didn't come in that way, you were going to leave that way.
Right, or if you're flying an airplane, if you're on a flight to Los Angeles, you want an obsessive compulsive pilot. You don't want a lackadaisical pilot. You don't want a careless pilot. You want a pilot with a little bit of anxiety, enough to not be careless, and with a significant amount of obsessiveness so that if that warning light goes on, he's not going to ignore it. Say, it's probably not a big deal. No, you want that person to really turn around and get that fixed. Or a surgeon. You want a very obsessive compulsive surgeon. You don't want a lackadaisical surgeon. So these elements that are helpful and adaptive in many career fields and throughout life are good. It's just that when they're extreme and you have severe obsessiveness, that's when it becomes problematic and you really might need some help in not eliminating that. We don't want to get rid of obsessiveness. We just want to tone it down into a more healthy region of functioning.
Yeah, I think this speaks to one of the questions I wanted to put to you, but mm-hmm. you may want to elaborate on it some more. To what extent, if any, is your Jungian orientation manifested in this book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it does, blend in there. The book is clearly clinical. I mean, this is a clinical mental health, book to look at a different, way of saying mental health. But it certainly does resonate with the Jungian side of me. I can't disconnect that. I'm a Jungian psychiatrist. I follow my therapy style, sort of the tenets of Carl Jung, not strictly. I do a lot of other things as well. But I look at archetypal aspects. I look at the shadow. I look at introversion, extroversion. Those are concepts I'm thinking about when I hear dreams or when I engage a client. So with this piece, it does fit in so much so we added a chapter on Jungian psychology. One of the chapters in the book is how does the concepts of Jungian archetypal psychology fit into particularly the spectrum of this. I think a real good example would be psychosis. Psychosis feels like such a negative piece of if you're psychotic, it's a scary space and people feel they're losing their mind or going insane. But a lot of the areas that Carl Jung delved into, were bordering on the version of psychosis. Some even feel that Carl Jung himself had a mild psychotic break, but that actually helped him in diving into the archetypal, world, with that. So we don't see psychosis as black and white, either, that you either have psychosis or you don't. But where are you in the field of second sight, of seeing reality in a different way, in creativity, in intuition, in gut feelings, all those are seeing a different aspect of reality. If that's mild to moderate, that's good. You're getting dreams, you're having visions, you might be a visionary person, you might have a different way of seeing something. In that extreme, though, that becomes problematic, and you might hallucinate and hear voices and be strongly delusional. Clearly, then it's gone too far. And the Jungian in me would even say that the archetypal world has penetrated into your ego psychology, and now that those archetypes are active in your conscious, and that's a hard place to be. It kind of overwhelms the psychic energy at those times.
Yeah. You've been quoted elsewhere as saying that there's no such thing as mental illness, yet I heard you use the word just a little bit earlier, and it's hard to get around it. I mean, it's so steeped mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. our vocabulary that sometimes I'm stumbling to not use that word. So say a bit about that, if there is no such thing as mental illness, what is there?
Mm-hmm. Right, and we kind of go back and forth within the book. There's a paradoxical nature to that. If we don't label mental illness, we don't get paid, to be frank. Uh-huh. As a psychiatrist or a therapist, you've got to fill out a form that says they have this diagnosis, major depression, recurrent, moderate, et cetera. So on one level, and I start the first 25 pages of the book listing all the mental health diagnoses. So they're all right there in black and white. That doesn't mean I like it, though, or that I see that as the best model. It's a model we're stuck with for now. We, as clinicians, have to put a label on somebody, both to communicate with an outside provider, to let them know what we think is going on, certainly to get reimbursed through any third-party payer if you're not self-pay. But there's some real drawbacks to that. There's some real dangers to it. I think the biggest danger is that labeling experience. I have so many clients that come in to see me and say, "Doc, I'm bipolar, and that's just what I am, and I feel like I'm losing my mind, and everybody laughs at me at it." And I really try to reorient that of you are not bipolar. That is not what defines you. You are a person who happens to have a higher level of bipolarity than average. And then I'll walk through the whole kind of spectrum, you know, bipolarity. And I let them know that neither end of the spectrum is that great. If you have zero bipolarity, well, then you're a boring, stuck-in-the-mud, dead kind of person that has no friends, no spontaneity, you know, sits in a cubicle counting beans all day. And that's a problem. And if that person comes to see me, I look at ways of increasing their bipolarity. Can we get them jazzed up a bit? Can they be spontaneous? Can they do something new? Can they, you know, develop some more friendships? So that if they're on the left end of the spectrum, what I'm calling the left end of zero bipolarity, that's a problem. We need to jazz them up some. Now, of course, if they're on the other end, if they're spending too much money, they're way in debt, they're saying things they regret later, they're impulsive, you know, or severe cases, you know, if they have psychosis breaking through from bipolarity, well, that's a problem as well. But we're not trying to eliminate that bipolarity. We want them in the middle. The middle range of bipolarity is an artistic, creative, spontaneous, life of the party, but not too much of the life of the party, you know, person. And we actually illustrate this in our book. We have this delightful young man, an elementary school student. We'll probably talk about him later. But this delightful young fella did all the illustrations for our book. And if you look at the bipolarity spectrum, on the left end of the spectrum, where we write zero, we have this guy that looks like in a cubicle, mounds of paper all around him. On the left, we have somebody throwing money around and running wild and kind of jazzed up. But in the middle, we have an artist who's painting a painting. We have a guy that's enjoying life who's dancing at a party. And it's that middle zone we want to be. We want to have spontaneity, creativity, energy, but not so much that causes trouble and that we, you know, do things that we regret later and can't contain our lives.
Well, let's go to that artist illustrator right now. I think you're being a bit modest. He's your son, right?
Well, no, he's related a bit, you know, to my son.
Oh,
but
okay.
He's
Luke
not my
Sloan,
son.
Right.
Luke Sloan is a young man who my son introduced me, you know, to. I was actually in Barnes and Noble's 2.5 years ago as I had this idea and was sketching it out and saying, no, we really need some neat, you know, images, cartoons, you know, for this. And my son was there, Brian Bucer. And Brian says, oh, Daddy, I've got the perfect, you know, guy, Luke. Luke's my buddy at the elementary school, and he does a great job, you know, drawing. I said, Brian, you know, we really need a professional graphic artist. You know, we don't need some kid doing this.
Yeah.
And but Brian persisted. He kept bugging me. And I said, well, okay, have Luke give me a portfolio, and I'll evaluate his work. And I'll be darned if this kid wasn't phenomenal. He gave me these sketches that were just great.
Yeah,
so
they
we
are
hired
great.
Him.
Yeah.
We hired him to do it. And then my other child, Sila, my daughter, Sila Bucer, she colored the front. So while Luke gave me all the images in black and white, we then did a compilation on the cover, and my daughter drew in the cover. So both my children were actively involved in the book. You know, Brian introduced me to the artist, and Sila, my daughter, colored in cover.
How great. Yeah, one would never guess that kids were involved, you know, with the cartooning in here. Looks totally supportive of the text.
He did great. He really did.
Yeah, and it looks very professional. So.
And elementary school. He's in middle school now, but he was in fifth grade when he did this.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. It was really fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, you sort of whipped us through the spectrums. You gave us a good feeling of detail, I think, discussing the bipolarity one. Take us through the other seven and fill them out a little bit for us like you did with the bipolarity so that we can kind of digest these eight.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Let me pull out that page so I can see the images that he did with that. The first one, we've got, page 29, if you have your book, is... And in that introduction, I list all the eight. They're kind of slides. We compiled all the drawings into these few pages just to have them all together. And then later on, we walk them through in more detail. But the first one we call Shallowness Versus Despair with a subtitle of How Much Sorrow Do You Hold? And that's saying that depression isn't all bad. I mean, people think of depression as bad. I want to be happy. I want to be always happy and not depressed. Depression's bad. And it's important to redefine that of, no, if you were happy all your life, first of all, you'd have nothing to compare with. You wouldn't know what not being happy was. But there's something about depth. Being able to hold sorrow with somebody is important. So that if your dear friend has lost a child or is in a bad space, being able to comfort and cry with them and enter that space is a capacity to hold depression. That's a good thing. So if you look at our cartoons on the left, the zero of the how much sorrow do you hold, we've got a guy walking past somebody who's in need, and his nose is stuffed up in the air. You can see just a shallow, indifferent, kind of arrogant space. And that's problematic. That's zero, sorrow, depressiveness. Then the full depressiveness, there's a man clearly, depressed, sitting on a chair, tears streaming down, looking at a noose. So he's contemplating suicide. That's the, 100 on the scale, somebody who's about to commit suicide. And in between is an empathic, caring person comforting a friend. So as is true in all these cartoons and spectrums, the key is being in the middle of you don't want to have extreme depressiveness, but you don't want to have zero depressiveness either. You want to be in the middle. Next one is bipolarity. We kind of talked about that one already.
Yeah.
Zero bipolarity, no creativity, full mania to the right, and being spontaneous, artistic, kind of in the middle. Next one we've got is anxiety. So we call that one carelessness versus anxiousness. How much vigilance do you have? And the scale is 0 to 100 of vigilance. Zero vigilance is a problem. And we have a tightrope walker walking between two buildings with no net. And we say, that's kind of careless. Now, maybe he's an expert in it, and it's not that bad, and we'll put him up to a 10 or 15. But for most people, walking a rope with no net, 10 stories up is reckless. The other extreme is high anxiety. And Luke drew a young man with a helmet and gloves and knee pads, a pillow tied to his front. And he is terrified of falling and anything bad in life happening. And that's somebody who has generalized anxiety disorder or panic disorder, who is fearful of everything. And that's a problem as well. The in-between we call robustly enjoying life. So a guy's in the convertible, the top's down, the sun's shining, driving a little bit fast, but not too fast. That's somebody who's not careless, but enjoying life and taking a little bit of risk in there. So that's the in-between anxiety. Mm-hmm. The psychosis one, that was the hardest one to develop, of what's a good level of psychosis. But when we changed it to vision and dreams, visionless versus psychotic, how strong are your dreams and visions? Then it seemed to come into space.
Yeah, that's so nice.
So somebody with no dreams or visions is back to that boring, uninspired guy. There's no other form of reality he can see. He's got no mystical sense. He's got no dreams. And that's a problem. And those people, we try to expand and grow. And what can you do to get more engaged and to have ideas, dreams, fantasies? Then the other extreme is psychosis. Somebody who's hallucinating, seeing aliens, hearing voices, that kind of intense psychosis that we all see. The middle, though, we actually put Martin Luther King in there, and I hope nobody takes offense at that, that wasn't in a negative way to say Martin Luther King was psychotic, but to say Martin Luther King or Gandhi or any number of folks are people that hold vision in a very powerful way. They're not psychotic. They're not boring. They can see a second sight, a vision beyond reality that's crucial for humanity. And Martin Luther King is a great example. And he's giving I Have a Dream speech in the middle of a cartoon with that. And Lou captured Martin Luther King. He did a great job with that. Next one is attention. Attention deficit disorder, ADD, versus obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. How much focus do you have? And that one, as we looked at attention and focusing, we thought, there's a middle section where you have healthy attention and can focus on things. But you might have too much intention, too much focus, and that's really OCD. You can't let go of it. You have these obsessive attention focus in your mind that you just can't let go of. Could be hand washing, could be counting, could be praying, but there's too much attention, and you're impaired by that. Too little attention is ADD, so somebody who can't sit still, can't focus. And really the optimal is somewhere in between. You have enough OCD where you don't make mistakes, but you can also let loose and be spontaneous, etc. The next one is substance abuse. We call that one the ascetic monk versus multiple addictions. How much pleasure do you seek? And that meaning that pleasure seeking is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with wanting to seek pleasure. But substance abuse is that on steroids. It's a client who is going way beyond their ability to pleasure themselves through drugs, through alcohol, through any addiction, gambling, sex, whatever it is out of control. So that's an addicted, you know, person. We put a monk on the other end. Nothing against monks. We like monks. You know, I'm a Catholic, you know, Christian myself. And we actually didn't make that pathologic, but we said for some people, not everybody, but for some people, you know, not following, you know, the pleasures of life is a problem. They're too restricted, too rigid. And if that isn't part of who they are spiritually or in other ways, we need to loosen them up. And the middle is somebody going out to dinner with a glass of wine with their partner, you know, toasting and having fun. They're seeking pleasure, but they're containing it. So again, the balance in that spectrum is right down the middle. So last two, hope I'm not boring you by throwing you through all these.
Okay. Of course, I have the benefit of having the book in my hand, which is supplementary as well.
Yeah, I wish we had slides I could put up for the audience. Yeah. But the last two, the second to last is autism versus codependency, which is how connected to others are you. You can be too connected. You can be too caretaking. You can be too codependent. And probably your listeners, you know, codependency and all the research and thoughts about that. But that's a caretaker on steroids, somebody who is too caretaking. The cartoon of that is, in this case, a wife who's picking up the phone with her husband who's virtually passed out, you know, with a beer on the sofa. And she's saying, oh, of course, honey, I'll call work and tell them you have the flu today, which is the classic codependent response. And that's somebody who's doesn't have good boundaries, is too enmeshed in a relationship. The other end is autism, severe autism, which is a mother, you know, looking at a little boy again playing with toys that says, please let me touch you, dear. And I almost cry when I think about it. It's this touching image of a mother disconnected, you know, from a son and really wanting to be connected. And of course, the healthy piece is in the middle of you're connected to people, but you have good boundaries. And, For that one, yeah, it's somebody who's able to confront with somebody, but they also enjoy and have a close, you know, friendship with that. The last one
I love this last one. Neurotic versus obnoxious. Obnoxious is now a technical clinical term.
Well, it's not, but I kind of made it that way. Made up that term.
Great.
Now, for that one, how much blame do you cast? Mm. And that's actually more of a psychodynamic principle. The old Freudian days, people used to talk a lot about this. Is this neurosis? Is it psychosis? Is it egocentric? Is ego dystonic? I won't get into all those kind of jargon. But the point was, for personality functioning, you either can see yourself and accept your blame and responsibility, or you can't, and you project that onto others. And that's a Jungian term, projection, but that's also a little bit Freudian as well. So on the left-hand side is the neurotic. And with neurotic, everything is my fault. We blame ourselves for everything. It's raining today. It's my fault. I know I did something wrong for that. The prototypical person is Woody Allen. I don't know if you've ever... Sure, yeah. Have you watched Woody Allen movies?
Obsessively.
And he is the perfect neurotic. He is absolutely neurotic, and he's, comedically so. His comedy with his neurosis is legendary. The opposite would be a obnoxious person, somebody who doesn't blame themselves whatsoever. It's all your fault. And for that cartoon, I've got this person saying, what I did was all your guy's fault. He's pointing at these three people. And the three folks are perplexed. What do you mean it's my fault what you did? And the personality disordered person, for DSM-5 terms, but within that spectrum, is where they don't own responsibility. Everything they do is because somebody made them, or they had to because they did X, Y, and Z. And the healthy functioning is the middle. We want to admit our faults and admit what we did. But we also want to confront others when they did do something that's inappropriate. So again, trying to achieve the balance. And psychotherapy is often working on that spectrum of how do we get people out of neurotically blaming themselves or projecting blame onto others, but have a healthy amount of blame on themselves, responsibility, when warranted.
Well, I really like this schema that you've developed here. And I'm blocking on a typology. There's a typology that people use. I don't remember if it's got eight or...
Oh, the Enneagram. There's
nine. Yes, Enneagram. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's sort of not coming from the world of mental health, but it's that mm-hmm. same idea of, coming up with a system that doesn't stigmatize people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Enneagram and Myers-Briggs and all those are just different ways of dividing up, you know, human behavior and how we, you know, behave and feel inside. And I do like the Enneagram because it's very non-judgmental, non-pathologic. And that's what we're trying to achieve in this book of looking mm-hmm. at mental health in a more positive light.
Yeah, this kind of bridges in a way. It's like it mm-hmm. bridges the old with the new. Mm-hmm. In chapter 14, you talk about the harmony of the lotus flower. Mm-hmm. Where does that come in? How did the lotus flower get into all this?
Yeah, the lotus flower is an image that we saw. In the harmony of the lotus flower, we're referring to a mental state of being, balanced within the eight primary spectrums. Within each spectrum, we want to avoid being on either extreme, but fluidly move towards the center. So the image we chose was taking the eight spectrums, folding them in half, and you almost have to see the book image to visualize this. But if you take a line, you fold in half, it becomes a U, basically. And the U, the middle of the U, is the middle of the spectrum. And we tied the eight U's together, and it looked like a flower. Mm-hmm. And so we said, being harmonized is being in the very center of all eight spectrums. And then there's a transcendent space, which is the harmony of the lotus flower. Not that you can ever completely, reach nirvana or reach that state, but trying to stay more or less in the middle of those eight spectrums puts you in a better functioning, role, but also in a calm, centered, peaceful, space. The living in the moment, the mindfulness movement that we hear so much of today, that's really what we're talking about. If you're in the center of these spectrums, you're more mindful. You're not reacting. You're just more present to each day as it comes. And that's the goal. The harmony of the lotus flower refers to this idyllic space that you want to get towards, never achieving completely, but being, more balanced in these eight spectrums and more living in the moment, in essence.
And does the Jungian idea of transcending the opposites somehow fit with that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where we try to roll in some of the Jungian, Carl Jung aspects of it. There's two ways of looking at the spectrums. You can be sort of a little more straightforward approach, which is you want to be 50-50. You want to be right in the middle, more or less, give or take 5 or 10 percentage, but you want to stay in the center, 50-50, half of this and half of that. And we said, that's okay. That's not a bad way of looking at it, if you want to compromise 50-50 in these two poles of the spectrum. But we thought, there's a higher calling to that. And the transcendence of the opposites, really fit that model for us, at least. And that's a Carl Jung, perspective. Jung wrote quite a bit on transcending the opposites, where it's not that you take half of this, half of that, and you're right in the middle, but somehow there's a new third. There's a therapeutic third that develops that's unique. It's part of this, part of that, but it's not just a 50-50 compromise, with that. There's something transcending that. So you, little manic, a little boring. You're not 50-50 of each. You kind of transcend it. You can engage those different harmonies when needed. It's a little bit like the duality of the wave particle debate in physics. Not to go too far into physics theory, but the light looks completely like a particle, but it also looks completely like a wave, and that's impossible. It can't be both, but yet it is both. And there's a transcendence of that duality, and ideally, that's what the full harmony of the lotus flower refers to, of somehow transcending those two poles and being in a new state of being with it.
Okay. Well, how did you get drawn to the Jungian perspective yourself?
Probably about 15 years ago or so, I had a varied career. I was the Air Force. I trained at Duke, medical school, but Duke was pretty expensive back then. So I got a military scholarship, and they paid, for my time at Duke. Then I had a 12-year kind of jaunt in the Air Force, and was in Ohio and Mississippi, Biloxi, a little bit overseas as well. And when I got out, I moved to Asheville and joined a private practice here. And at some point, trying to get my legs underneath me of what therapy model am I most drawn to. And I like cognitive behavioral. I like some aspects of psychodynamic Freudian. But one of my psychology buddies here had just a marvelous form of engaging with clients, and I really apprenticed myself to him. Bill Matthews is his name, and Bill is just a phenomenal therapist. And the more I worked with Bill, I really saw the type of work he did as having depth and meaning. And at first I asked what he was, and he said, "Oh, I'm just eclectic, I do this or that." But the more books he recommended to me, they turned out all to be Jungian books. And after a while, I said, "Bill, you're a Jungian, aren't you?" And he kind of smiled and admitted to it. And from that point, I was hooked. I kept reading the books. I did a two-year fellowship up at the C.G. Jung Institute of Chicago back in 2006, where I flew up once a month and did some training up there. I'm not a full analyst, but I did a two-year clinical training program at the Institute. And from there, formed the Asheville Jung Center. So my last month I was in Chicago, I met Murray Stein. He lives in Switzerland, Zurich, but happened to be visiting Chicago, where he had lived for a number of years, and was really enamored with Murray's writings. He's a marvelous author.
Yes.
I kind of cornered him one day and said, "Hey, Murray, could we do a seminar, from Asheville, to Zurich? Would you be willing to teach us?" He said, "Well, we could try it once and see how it worked." So I went home and talked to our guys back then. This is before Skype. This is 2008, when it wasn't that easy to do. And we set up a Polycom satellite hookup. But we had this marvelous lecture on individuation from Murray. And before I knew it, Chicago joined in as a site, and Mexico joined in, and Omaha. And pretty soon I had 50 countries around the world all plugging in live instruction from Zurich, Switzerland.
Yeah, and I got to see that. I was in the audience for one of the California nodes. Yep.
Oh, wonderful.
Pretty sure.
Yeah, right. And it just came. We had no desire to form the Asheville Jung Center. It just really was birthed on its own. It just came forth. And the more people saw this top-notch training from Switzerland, and Zurich, of course, is the mecca for the Jungians, because that's where Carl Jung himself was raised, or at least practiced for all the years there. Küsnacht, right outside of Zurich, the main institutes are out there. So the fact that we have the world-leading Jungian analysts out of Zurich that are happy to teach every so often is just marvelous. We have one on the shadow coming up, on evil in the shadow. And within a few weeks, I think in October, we're going to do a 5-series seminar on kind of Jung in the shadow and evil and even psychopathic killers, how all that is really an archetypal manifestation in many ways.
Great.
And it is fun to do. I just love the teaching we've been able to develop with that.
Yeah. Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything more that you'd like to add.
What would I add? I guess just to highlight the last piece of that, this book that we did isn't a Chiron book. We spun off a imprint of it that we call InnerQuest Books, because it's really not Jungian. There's a chapter on Jung, but it's really not a Jungian book. So we're keeping true to the Chiron model. ChironPublications.com is our main publishing venture, and that's pure Jungian. So if you look at the last 30 years of books that Chiron has put out, they're the classics from Murray Stein and Edward Edinger and all kinds of really big name James Hollis. And those are the books that we really just love, birthing with that. And we're continuing with that. We even have one on marijuana, which is not so much a Jungian book, but that's another kind of big title that's coming out, really looking at the pros and cons, but uh-huh. There's a lot of research into what marijuana does, particularly with the teenage brain. So we're trying to get the word out there. We've got this clinical, book imprint, but we also have the psychological book imprint, which has been a delight to shepherd as well.
Yeah, well, that all sounds wonderful. Well, this has been a much more interesting conversation than talking about the DSM-5 would normally
bring to mind. User, I would think.
Yeah.
Right. Area number 6.
So I hope none of my listeners skip it, because of the title. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Steve Buser, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, Dave. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a delight talking to you. We'll be right back.
Well, this interview turned out to be more interesting than I expected. And also, I think it will be of interest to a wider audience than just those who are in a therapeutic practice where they have to submit diagnostic codes for insurance reimbursement. Although, if you are someone who is in that position, my advice is to grab this book right away so that you can be up to speed without getting overwhelmed. I'm amazed by the amount of ground Dr. Bucer and his co-author, Dr. Cruz, were able to cover in this slim volume of 100 pages. Not only do they manage to cover a lot of the specifics of both the DSM-5 and the ICD-10, but they also bring it all into a kind of coherence with their innovative 8-spectrums model. I love the way they normalize these conditions by de-emphasizing pathology and instead describe a model in which we all will find ourselves somewhere on each of the 8 continua: sorrow, creativity, vigilance, dreams/visions, ability to focus, amount of pleasure-seeking versus addictiveness, degree of connectedness to others, and amount of blame cast to others. You don't have to be a Jungian to buy into this model either. It seems to me it just makes a kind of non-blaming sense that helps us to get away from pathological labeling. I think our field needs more of this kind of thinking. I suspect many of you out there will agree. So once again, the title of Dr. Steven Bucer's book is DSM-5 Insanely Simplified. And as always, you're encouraged to purchase this book using the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Josune, and I just had made a donation to your podcast, and it feels really good doing it. So it's something that I wanted to do for a long time. I am listening to your podcast for the last couple of years. I have just graduated from clinical psychology, marriage family therapist, and while I was taking a break, I will download your podcast and go on a hike or my long commute, and I really enjoyed it, and it's been something that I really wanted to do, make a donation to, as a small gesture, to say thank you so much for all the good work that you do, Dr. Dave. And I wanted to encourage other listeners to do so, and so that you can keep doing what you do. So anyhow, thank you so much for the wonderful work that you do, and I encourage other listeners to do so. Thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Josune. And congratulations on the completion of your academic program. Since the last show, we've had 2 additions to our honor roll of donors. So big thanks goes out to Barbara Favre and Rhonda Horn. Well, I tell you, never have your donations felt more important than this last week, in which I was in something of a panic over the future of Shrink Wrap Radio. You might have seen the emergency bulletin I posted in the podcast feed. I don't know if their rules changed or what, but the web hosting company I've been using unexpectedly sent me a notice that I was taking up too much space on their shared server and that I had 24 hours in which to reduce my approximately 80 gigabytes stored there to less than 5 gigabytes. 80 gigabytes down to 5 gigabytes in only 24 hours? I wasn't sure how I could accomplish that. It seemed that either I would have to stop providing access to past shows and transcripts, or I would have to move to a dedicated server. But a dedicated server costs more than our current donation level can support. I frantically looked into other possible hosting companies, but they all had a limit on the amount of data they would allow in a shared server environment. Finally, Steve Post of Quan Web Studios, who helped convert Shrink Wrap Radio to a WordPress environment some years back and whom I continue to rely on for technical help, suggested that I look at Bluehost.com. Amazingly, they do not have a limit on disk space for a shared server. And although they cost a bit more per month than my previous host, they are affordable. The 24-hour deadline to get my data off of the old host was like a sword of Damocles hanging over my head all week, because I had to keep begging them for more time to get the migration to Bluehost completed. Even though I paid Bluehost to do the migration, it was taking longer than expected. Even after they got all the data transferred over, we were having problems moving all my email over and getting my email functioning on the new site. So this past week has been nerve-wracking, with hours of waiting on technical support calls, desperate emails back and forth, and lost sleep. Today is the first day my email is fully functioning again. And so, all's well that ends well, and with your continued support, I hope to keep this podcast rolling along in the fashion you've come to expect for some time to come. By the way, a special thanks goes out to Jim and Colleen Lowry for sending a $200 check in response to my crisis posting to help me get through the emergency. Thank you so much, Jim and Colleen, for helping me to keep going, both in terms of the podcast and emotionally. It could not have come at a better time. Once again, let me remind you to go to the survey tab on our site to take the updated survey. And thanks to all of you who have ordered our new app. I'm hearing great reports on it. The downside of the app, I'm realizing, however, is that it eliminates the need for you to go to our website, which is where you need to go in order to make donations, order books by our guests, or take advantage of any of the other affiliate offers. So I do hope you'll continue to go to shrinkwrapradio.com from time to time. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, have I ever got a deal for you? How about this for a deal? 43 plus hours, that's free, listening to my favorite novel of the past 10 years or more. I'm talking about Shantaram by Australian author Gregory David Roberts, and the novel is based on his own experiences of escaping from an Australian maximum security prison, going to India, and entering Bombay's hidden society of beggars and gangsters, prostitutes and holy men, soldiers and actors, and Indians and exiles from other countries who seek in this remarkable place what they cannot find elsewhere. Now, that's reading from what they have posted at audible.com. But above all, it's a great love story. I don't usually keep novels after I've read them, but this one is staying on my bookshelf, and I'll definitely want to come back to it at some point and enjoy the adventure all over again. So if you're not already an audible.com subscriber, you can get this 43-hour audiobook for free and to keep, with no obligation to continue your subscription, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that one's not to your taste, they have more than 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hello, this is Dr. David Sowerby, and I'm a consultant, psychology teacher, and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, David Sowerby, who was my guest on episodes number 1 and number 349, both about intuition and dreams. I'm afraid I've got no new emails to share, so I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, and you can also use our app for that. Thanks to today's guest, Steve Buser, MD, for sharing his insights into DSM-5 and the ICD-10, as well as his outlook on diagnostics in general. My next interview will be with the noted Israeli Jungian analyst, Dr. Arel Shalit, and we'll be discussing his book, The Cycle of Life, Themes and Tales of the Journey. I'm really looking forward to this one, and I hope you'll join us. So until then, This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've got the key to the highway, feet up and ready to go. Oh, I'm listening to Dr. Dave, that old shrink wrap radio. Now when the moon peep on the mountain, I'll be on my way, listening to that quiet little voice, I walk along life's old highway. Now I've got the key to the highway, got myself freed up and I've got to grow. Oh, taking to the air now, walking's most too slow. So come with me now, people, let's go explore the great unknown. We got the key to that inner highway, that's where we're meant to roam. So open up your hearts now, people, it's the only way to grow. Love is the key to that highway, you heard it on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.